Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Good morning, everyone. 4 minutes after the hour, I caught a very interesting clip by Tim Tebow, the big football star who's now becoming a baseball star. How about that? They had to try to figure out how he balances his work and sports and all of his charity work he does. Let's hear this clip. It's great.
So much of handling sports is handling pressure. Well, what pressure do you have if you're 0 for 12 and you're at the plate versus someone that is fighting for their life, versus someone that, you know, we picked up on the side of the street in Haiti because they're crippled or they're not wanted or they're thrown in the garbage? Like, how do you compare those things? And for me, there's not a comparison, and that's why you're able to handle sports as a game, because it still is. Yeah, we can pursue it. We can give so much of our time, energy, and effort to it, but at the end of the day, I know that's not why I'm here. It's not my biggest purpose. It's not my biggest calling. It's not what I want to be. It's not how I want to be known in my life. It's not as a football player, as a baseball player, as, you know, someone that, you know, worked hard to accomplish those things. I want my life to be so much more than that. I want to be someone that was known for bringing faith, hope, and love to those needing a brighter day in their darkest hour of need. And that is something that is a life calling for me, and so it's so much bigger than sports. But I am so grateful for sports because it's given me a platform to be able to share and love and care for people all over the world. So I wouldn't trade that for anything.
That's pretty strong testimony. I really love his passion, and he's making a big difference with his voice, and he's standing strong for Christ. And I think his sports and his life has been really a great testimony. You know, Rebecca, I only want guests on my show that make me look good. Who do we have coming up?
We have John Wheaton and Reverend Hunter coming up.
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to figure out plan B. No, but we're going to have John Wheaton. You know, you go to... You know, usually we have David Wheaton on Thursdays, right?
Yes.
But David's not available, so I went to the Wheaton bullpen, which is a very strong bullpen, by the way. And team captains would be Bruce and Mary Jane, probably listening right now. And so I got John, and John is the executive director of Inner City Tennis, and Reverend Johnny Hunter is the executive director of the Hospitality House. And they've had a little meeting of the minds, and they're doing some great work together. So I think we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to have a wonderful discussion on how important it is to get your kids involved and learn all the good things you can learn about sports, how it teaches you discipline and really good habits, not to mention it makes your body healthier, all a good thing. It is 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break and be right back. Good morning, friends. It's 8 minutes after the hour. I'm glad you're with us today. Bill Arnold here in studio watching the sun come up. Well, it's kind of already come up, but it's been an especially pretty sunrise today. And I have on the studio line my friends, that's plural, John Wheaton, who is the executive director of Inner City Tennis, and the Reverend Johnny Hunter, who is the executive director of the Hospitality House in Minneapolis. Gentlemen, I say that with some reservation. Welcome to the show.
How are you, Bill?
I'm good. Now, let's start with tennis, because it's a subject I love. Tennis player myself for many, many years. And let's talk about, John, the work you're doing at Inner City Tennis.
All right. Well, thanks, Bill, for having me on the show. Inner City Tennis is about helping kids, and we do that through the sport of tennis, which is a vehicle to get kids interested and active and connected with our staff. And the ultimate goal is to get into their lives a little more off the court and help them develop some kind of life skills and a direction in life, a pathway in life toward success. And so we serve about 5,000 kids a year, most of them from underserved communities in the city of Minneapolis. And our goal is just to give them a good alternative to life other than some of the things that kids can fall into. So we're in 24 parks in the summers. We have our own location right in South Minneapolis in the Martin Luther King Park there. We have indoor courts there. And we're in schools as well. So we're pretty active around the city.
Now, John, give me a quick example of someone that comes to mind who might have slipped through the cracks that got involved in inner city tennis and then got their life back on track.
Okay, a good example would be a young lady from St. Paul who happened to be connected with one of our coaches. And from a very young age, he kind of discovered her on a park over there. And she's now one of the best players in the upper Midwest, the northern section, and plays national tournaments. And I think without the sport of tennis and without connecting with our coach, you know, she would have probably fallen into other things, you know, all the other temptations that life brings you. So, you know, she connected with Song Tower program director, and, you know, he started out by giving her a few lessons. She got into other programs that we have, free programs, and pretty soon she's in a high-performance program and you know, playing all the way to the top. So
that's pretty
kind of a prime example.
That's pretty awesome. Now, Reverend Hunter, I wouldn't think that tennis would be maybe the first thing kids from the inner city might be drawn to, but they love it, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. I mean, it's, we have a great partnership with Inner City Tennis, and our kids really haven't never experienced indoor tennis, which is great over there at King Park with John. Most of our kids are actually basketball and baseball players, but love tennis also. So mm-hmm. it's a great relationship.
Now,
we have
the Hospitality House, truly one of the most amazing places on earth. Tell our listeners a little bit more about what it does and how it serves the inner city.
Well, Hospitality House, been on the north side of Minneapolis for over 55 years. And one of the things we do is take kids, bring them into our building, and give them a safe place to be. One thing about the north side of Minneapolis, which you know, Bill, is it can be dangerous at times. And so Hospitality House brings them in a safe environment. But along with that safe environment, we try to teach emotional and social learning skills through the power of Jesus Christ. And so our ministry actually is spiritual, intellectual, and physical for the youth in our community.
Mm-hmm. And we all know
89%.
Oh, go ahead. No, you go ahead, Rev.
No, I was going to say 89% of our children are single mothers.
Wow, that's quite a statistic. And kids, if they don't feel safe, especially after school, that's, I think, where trouble can begin. Fair?
Yes, you're 100% right, because there's so many other choices they could make besides coming to the Hospitality House. And I think John could testify to this, the same thing over there at Inner City Tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, Rev, I'll cut in here, Bill. Bill, I wanted to say that the big thing that I think Rev and I have got is a partnership. We couldn't do it. It really works when we work together to help kids. Every kid needs a support structure, a team, so to speak, that they can count on of adults. And if they don't have that in their home or in their community, they can get it through organizations like Inner City Tennis and Hospitality House. And we try to create, like Rev said, that safe environment, but also the people, so they can connect with some people that care and can really nurture them through those difficult years of youth and give them an alternative to those other choices they might have.
Mm-hmm. Kids just need to know that people care about them, don't they? And have eyes on
Definitely.
Them. And when they come into the Hospitality House or they come into the Dome to play tennis or outside during the summer, that they've got people that care about them, that are paying attention to them. It's a big deal.
That is exactly right. I tell my pros and coaches, I say the first thing about a coach or a mentor is the kids need to know that you care. That's the first quality you need.
Yeah, that's great. All right, gentlemen, stay on the line. I'll go ahead, Rev.
No, I said I agree with John 100%.
Okay, and you agree with me 100%, so we're all agreeing 100%, which I love. I love this 100% club. And we're all in it right now.
I don't agree with everything you think 100%.
Pipe down, John. Pipe down. This is the only week we're having you on. David, we have David next week, all right? So we'll take a little break when we come back. More with these guys in just a minute. Bill Arnold here. Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back.
then I take it a day at a time. Sure enough, that day would end, then a new one would begin. Looks like I've made it a day at a time.
All right, that's how we do life, yeah. Day at a time. I'll bring a little country music there for you, Rev. I'm talking to Reverend Johnny Hunter and John Wheaton. John is from Inner City Tennis, and the Reverend John Hunter is from Hospitality House. And Reverend, I wanted to let our listeners know that you are the executive director of Hospitality House, but you were once served by the Hospitality House as a kid.
Yes, sir. I grew up in the program in 1967, and it made a great difference in my life. Even though I experienced some of the negative of the inner city of North Minneapolis, but through the power of Jesus Christ and the upbringing at the Hospitality House, I was able to get back on my feet and make the right choices and then come back and give to the community.
And give,
so it's been a great experience.
And giving you are indeed doing, as is John Wheaton over in North, you're not North Minneapolis, you're more at around 40th and Nicollet at the Dome.
Correct.
The Sweat Tennis Center and the Inner City Tennis Program offers inner city kids an opportunity to get involved in a sport that they may not have access to. They may not have interest within their own families, but they show up and they get instruction and they get some guidance and they get some discipline. And it can be a game changer for these kids.
Well, that's right. And you mentioned the key word is access. You know, most people, a lot of people, and especially in the inner city, kids who don't grow up around tennis kind of might think that it's a country club sport. It's only accessible to a few that are wealthy, you know, Lifetime Fitness. You got to have a membership, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. So we break those barriers down and say, no, we are open to everyone. And we are a public organization. So We cater to adult tennis players as well. So our tennis center, we have adults and seniors, very active, you know, adult programming going on as well. But our focus is kids. Our mission is to kids. And so, yeah, we open those doors of access and say, you are welcome here. You're part of the club, so to speak. And tennis is a fun sport. It's actually a fairly inexpensive sport. You can play tennis out in a public park. We have the best park system in the U.S., in Minneapolis. And so they can get access to a court. All they need is a racket and a few balls, which we give to them, and they can play.
Mm-hmm. And one of the great joys for me is watching the two of you get together and knock heads and figure out a better way to do things collectively. Comment on that.
That's right. That's such a, like I said earlier, such a key part of it is partnering together. You know, Reverend Johnny has such a great program at Hospitality House. And, you know, they've been there for, I don't know how long, Rev, you've been there, a long time, over 55 years, you said. We've been around, we're celebrating our 65th anniversary this year, and we've been doing this a long time. And there was a guy that brought us together, Bill. I think you forgot to mention this, but there was one guy who brought us together, and that was you. You were the one last year who said, you know, you got to meet Reverend Hunter. And I said, I definitely want to. And that's how our partnership got started.
Well, I'm blushing right now, so thank you. But
well, that's a great thing, boy. God really used you, and our relationship was almost made in heaven because it's been that good. I mean, our kids are really expanding their geographical senses by playing tennis, and that's one of the goals we're trying to do is let the kids know that there's more to life just the inner city, though, also. We have, taking them out to colleges and doing other things, and hopefully one day they'll be able to know that they have access to the great colleges in Minnesota and abroad. And so we can do that, and just like the Bible says, we can just save one. We did a lot, but we're really trying to save a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm. And John, I did not know that Inner City Tennis was around 65 years, and I know you try to cater to the entire community, and I know you love the Lord, but really the goal of Inner City Tennis is to get kids from the inner city on the courts and learning about all the good things that are associated with athletics and sports and just connecting with other kids and adults.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, being an athlete yourself and having grown up playing tennis, what a great sport tennis is. Any sport is great to play for kids. It's great for all the reasons we all know. But tennis in particular is an individual sport. It makes you look inward, makes you kind of confront yourself to a certain extent. And so we can use that as coaches and mentors to help kids understand who they are and kind of the issues in their lives that they need to deal with. And we're not a faith-based organization like mm-hmm. Hospitality House. Mm-hmm. We share similar values that are universal good values around, you know, just teaching kids to persevere and have integrity and to use teamwork in what they do. And so, I mean, it's just great to work with kids. It gives my life so much purpose. I've been doing it since my mom pushed me out the door and said, take care of your little brother, Nathan.
Right.
And
right.
I've been doing it ever since.
Right. And it really is a great sport where you say you do have to take yourself on. I mean, if I'm playing basketball with Rev and he throws me a bad pass, I can blame it on him. But in tennis, go within and find out, battle your own little demons, don't you?
That's exactly right. You're on a journey of self improvement, and your life is kind of your soul is laid bare out there. I know when my brother was playing professional tennis, you know, center court, Wimbledon, whole world watching. I mean, they weren't just looking at his tennis skills. They were looking at what makes him tick. You know, what will he be like under pressure? You know, what will make him crack? And that's pretty revealing.
Yeah. And Reverend Hunter probably is the best athlete to ever come out of North, hockey and basketball. And I know I'm killing you, but it's true. And you're just saying that. I'm just saying it. And you know it's kind of true, but you're just laughing because you're nervous. And I appreciate that, but, you know, sports has been great to the Wheatons and to the Reverend Hunter. And again, you're taking your love for athletics and moving it, paying it forward, helping kids get involved in the joy of sports and the disciplines of athletics, learning about teamwork, learning about individual responsibility, and then just having a place where kids can go where they can feel safe. Like, Rev, you said 89% of the kids there come from single homes, single-parent homes. It's just single moms.
Mm-hmm.
They need influence correct. Like you, my friend, in their lives. I just applaud you both.
Well,
thank you, Bill. I wanted to say also, we create these this environment for these kids, but we couldn't do it without such a supportive community. I cannot tell you how supportive the people of Minneapolis, the greater Twin Cities have been. I'm sure Reverend Hunter can say the same thing. So many people. Uh-huh. It really, truly, it takes a family to raise a child. It also takes a village. And, you know, we're just kind of at the tip of the spear of doing that, but it's just great to have so much support out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love you both, and I love the fact that you guys have become friends, so this is all good news for me. Thanks so much for being on the show, and have a great day.
Great, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks
a lot,
you Bill. Thank you, Bill.
See you later, Rev.
All right, see you. It's 25.
God bless you all.
Okay. Thank you. It's 25 minutes after the hour. Good morning, everyone. Glad you're with us. Take a little break and be right back. In Job chapter 23, he says, "But he knows the way that I take when he has tested me. I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I have kept to his way without turning aside." Great encouragement. We'll take a little break and come back with Tom Berkowitz. We're going to talk about what's going on with the anti-Semitism. Be back in a minute. Five minutes after the hour, while Lent is a time to reflect on our lives and confess our sins to God, it's important to not wallow in shame. Author and speaker Jane Rubietta explains the difference between guilt and shame.
In Genesis 2, it says Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed. And then Genesis 3:1 says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals." And the serpent starts sowing doubt. And the shame started to show up because they wanted to cover themselves because they knew they had done something wrong. And their eyes were opened to that. And so there was guilt there, but the shame says, "I'm defective. I'm a mistake. God made a mistake when God made me." That's what shame does to us. Guilt is just the this is wrong, and I'm going to repent of that, and then I'm going to be forgiven, and then I'm going to be free. And so it's this continuum where eventually guilt, if it's handled well, leads you to freedom. If it's not handled well, it leads to shame because you are not dealing with it. And then the enemy comes in. So repentance during this season is a really good one, because unrepentant, when we are not confessing and we are carrying sin around with us, then we begin to realize how really desperately wicked we are. But then we start to question whether God could possibly love us. And that's where shame starts.
For that full interview with Jane, you can visit our website at myfaithradio.com. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Tom Berkowitz. Stay tuned, everyone.
Looks can be deceiving, and you can't judge a teen by his behavior any more than you can judge a book by its cover. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Moms and dads have a habit of labeling disobedient kids as rebels. But 9 times out of 10, their so-called rebellion is just a natural response to a past or present issue in their life. Unless parents understand the root cause, they won't be able to stop the behavior and encourage healing within the family. If you're the parent of a so-called rebellious teenager, here's my question for you. Is your teen's inappropriate behavior actually rebellion or the symptoms of a deeper issue? So go beyond what you see and look into the heart of your teen. What looks like rebellion to you could really be a cry for help.
Learn how to argue effectively with a new free download from Mark Gregston. Go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Good morning, everyone. 37 minutes after the hour, Bill Arnold here with you. You know, Jewish community centers are supposed to be the pillars of unity and peace, where both Jews and non-Jews can enjoy sports and classes and other communal activities. But recently, there's been over 100 Jewish community centers that have turned into targets of hate, subject to bomb threats, and fears of heightened anti-Semitism is spreading all across the country. My guest today, Tom Berkowitz, has said that maybe anti-Semitism might be one of the oldest hates around. And I want him to weigh in this morning with his perspective. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, now
Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. There's been so many recent high-profile occasions of anti-Semitism with the graveyard vandalism and the bomb threats. What are you making of all of this?
Well, this has been going on for centuries. And it's getting more and more prevalent throughout the United States, but even so worldwide. Anti-Semitism is up in the UK. In France, it's up almost 100%. And throughout the world, there is Jews are being targeted and persecuted, and physically, emotionally. So this is really... It's more the old stuff, but it's getting to be more and more prevalent today. And the increase in anti-Semitic incidences have increased dramatically over the last year to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what are some of the impact of these threats? I mean, how is it affecting us societally and also you personally?
Well, I think it's a negative as a society. We live in a free society here in the United States, one where we should be able to express ideas and be part of society. And even in our differences, we can agree that we differ without having to feel that you're going to get persecuted, that mm-hmm. you're going to be physically assaulted. I know there's a lot of Jewish people are afraid to go out. They stick closer to their homes and in their communities and afraid to go out. On college campuses, it's running rampant, and most of it's in protests against Israel. Well, from my perspective, Israel is nothing more than the corporate Jew. So it filters down from there worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it's based on fear and emotion and lack of really any reason for this at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Jews throughout the world and in American society, they're good citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They bring value to the society and to the economy, they enrich people like a lot of other people groups do.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you're a fearless, devoted follower of Jesus, but also Jewish. So how was it affecting you personally? Now, you say some people don't even want to leave their house. I thought you were talking about me there for a minute because I never want to leave my house, but you weren't.
Yeah.
You were talking about your Jewish friends. How does it affect you personally?
Well, to me, I'm always on guard. I watch. I keep my ears open. I tell my kids to be careful, to listen, and to watch for trouble. I have a daughter that's a teacher. I won't mention this where or the school district, but in her class just this past May, so May of 2016, in preparing her kids, her students for a final, they were all signing on to a educational site they use, and they use a pseudonym name, the sign-on
mm-hmm.
name.
Mm-hmm.
And when she was looked at the screen to see if everybody is ready, here's two of the sign-on names. I hate Jews. And the other one said, Jews must burn. Now, where does that come from?
Wow.
It has to come from their parents,
mm-hmm.
especially in a town where there's little or no Jewish presence at all.
Yeah. Well, I hope she's not teaching first grade.
Yeah. Pardon me?
I said, I hope she's not teaching first grade.
Oh, no, it was in high school.
Oh, that is so scary.
I mean, so that's real. That's real. And they wouldn't even know she's Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Because she's married and she has married a non-Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So the name wouldn't even give an indication of that.
Mm-hmm. Tom, why do you think this hatred is seems to be cropping up now? I mean, you mentioned earlier it's always been around, it's always present. And what is it about what's going on in the world right now that makes it so much bigger?
Well, I think because of whenever you have economic pressures, whenever you have tensions worldwide, they look for a reason, and I think one of the oldest reasons are the Jews, which makes no sense whatsoever because worldwide there might be 16 million Jews. They're, one-tenth or two-tenths of the world population?
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes no sense to pick on them. And wherever they've gone, they've been an integral part of society. So it begs the larger question, what's going on here? And I think if you go back to the first prophecy in the Bible, Genesis 3:15, and where God is talking to Adam, Eve, and the serpent, and he said he'd put enmity between the seed of the woman and the serpent. And we know that the seed of the woman ultimately went through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, and is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So if the serpent, the evil one, can destroy the Jewish people, that makes God a liar because God made a promise that his salvation would come from through a Jewish person, through the Jews. And if you destroy the Jews and his promise that he made to Abraham, well, then God is a liar. So I think it's a bigger thing is it's a war against God.
Yeah.
And I think that's why you see it more and more. Paul writes about it in Ephesians, I believe it's 6. Our war is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers and principalities of the heavenlies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's that underlying current, and then you see it as it ignites the hate, because it's irrational. It's irrational. But on the other hand, we see God's power and grace. What other people have lost their land and their language for 2,000 years and remained a distinct people other than the Jews?
That's a good point.
And that was through the Crusades, through the Spanish Inquisitions, the pogroms, which my family lived through, the Holocaust, which my family lived through, and still remained a people.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. Tom, we're going to take a little break. Stay on the line. Lots more with Tom Berkowitz. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here. I will be right back. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We've been talking with Tom Berkowitz about some of the more recent high-profile occasions of anti-Semitism. And, Tom, you were doing such a nice job of talking about the suffering and the biblical, what the Bible has to say about anti-Semitism, referring back to the relationship between the serpent and Eve. But what is the Bible... What does the Bible say about how we're supposed to respond when you have this kind of bias against you as a Jewish person?
Well, Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love your Lord our God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as ourselves. We need to not return violence with violence, but violence with love and walk in the truth and the light of our faith in Jesus. As the church itself, they should be the standard bearer against any type of hate and any type of prejudice against any people group, but especially from the Jews, because their roots are from the Jews. And there's a great book that I would recommend everyone to read. It was written back in the early 90s by a friend of mine, Michael L. Brown, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood. And it tells the history of the church, and it's well documented with a lot of footnotes of the church perpetrating anti-Semitism, and which is on the surface something that I can't, it would be hard to believe, but people, I lead a Bible study 30 weeks out of the year, and we have over 500 people registered, and this year we're doing Isaiah, and everybody wants to know why Jews don't believe in Jesus when you see all the clear prophecies in Isaiah. And I say one of the biggest reasons is because of persecution they received from the church. And now the church has an opportunity. We as followers of Jesus have an opportunity, instead of giving them the back of our hand, to embrace them in love and show them the love of Jesus. And it's a different, that's the way we need to walk our life every day. I know of instances in Israel where Muslims who hate Jews in the war in Syria, where Jewish doctors would get them on the Syrian side and treat them over in the Israeli side. They've never met a Jew, but they've been told they need to hate them. And then they have to take them to the hospital because their wounds are so bad. They get Arab-speaking healthcare people to help with their care so they can speak to them in their language. And on numerous times they said, we've never met a Jew. We were told to hate them. But now that we've met them and felt how they took care of us, I have to rethink what how we view them. So a lot of it's education. A lot of it is, you know, we just need to spend more time and find out why we hate them. And I think that's one of the things. On the college campuses, it's just running crazy. Even in the local campuses around school, at the University of Minnesota, they've had at least three or four overt anti-Semitic attacks, swastikas on people's rooms, physical threat, emotional threat to students. And the University of Minnesota is looking into that and trying to stop it, but it's all over on campuses, and most of it's misinformation. Most of it is, I mean, it's driven by hate from outside sources, and young people tend not to do a lot of due diligence. They just, they, whatever they read on the internet or social media is truth without really pushing through and checking to see if these things are true and finding out Jews aren't evil people. They're like all other people. They just want to live and have peace with one another. But we as a church have an obligation to and a duty to show our love to all people groups, especially to the Jewish people.
I agree. Tom, we just have a couple minutes left, but I'd love to hear just a little bit of your story and how your background, you came to faith in Christ as a Jewish man.
My walk, I started off when I was a senior in high school. In the spring of my senior year, my father is Jewish. He and I had gotten in an argument, and about 2 minutes later, he had a heart attack, and I went and picked him up, and he died in my arms. So I thought I killed my father. And later, because it was on a Saturday, we had to wait until the Sabbath broke, the Shabbat was over, and then I ended up getting in an argument with the rabbi. I ended up cursing the rabbi and God. And from there, I was the enemy of God, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But through a lot of love from actually Christian people, I started softening. My college roommate, who was my drinking buddy, became a born-again Christian. And it would drove me nuts. And he shared the faith. My mother-in-law and father-in-law lived a godly life. And I saw how they lived. And it was so utterly different from what I had seen in the world. And it was because of their faith in Jesus. So I started reading and studying. And to make a long story short, after reading through the Gospels, literally over 50 times, I didn't bother with the other parts of the New Testament because to me it was all about Jesus. If he was a phony, then the whole faith was wrong. But I ended up falling in love with this guy and trying to embrace what he was espousing. And then one day I was reading in Romans. I came to Romans 5:8, which says, "But God demonstrates his love for you in this, while you were still a sinner, Christ died for you." I read that. I was a firstborn son of a Jewish man. I was expected to perform, and I never performed up to expectation because they kept moving the goal and because the goals were high. So I read that verse, Tom, "God demonstrates his love for you in this. While you were still not performing up to expectation, Messiah died for you."
Mm.
And it crushed me.
Wow.
And I said, "I want to follow this." And that this person, that was over 38 years ago, and I've dedicated my life to following Jesus.
Tom, that's great. You're choking me up here. Your story is so strong. I appreciate you coming and sharing your testimony.
I might put in one plug for your audience who would like to hear more about Jewish testimonies, go to the website ifoundshalom.com. There's probably 70, 80 video testimonies of Jewish people from all walks of life who give their testimony of how they found Jesus. And they'll give them a good background of what Jews go through to come in to the knowledge of Jesus as their Messiah. It's put out by Chosen People Ministries. Mitch Glazer is a good friend of mine. He's going to be in town in 2 weeks and staying with us. And he's the one that's done it, and it's been the amount of hits they've gotten from their Hebrew edition in Israel, over almost a million hits.
Wow, that's powerful.
In Hebrew. So we know those are Jewish people.
Yeah, wow, no kidding. Tom, thanks so much for being on the program this morning. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks a lot. It's 56 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break and be right back to wrap things up. Thanks for being with us today. Time flies, doesn't it? 58 minutes after the hour. You've got 2 minutes to get to work or whatever you're doing if you have to be there at the top of the hour. I am so glad you let us come into your house or your car this morning, whatever you were doing. It means a lot that you let us in. I just wanted to let you know I was praying this morning for Governor Dayton, who's having prostate surgery today. He's undergoing that at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. I understand it's a pretty reputable facility over there. And he's having his prostate removed, and he's going to try to then get back to work. So God bless him today. And I hope everyone else has a great day. Keep your radio tuned, or you can get us on the Faith Radio app. Listen to us all day long. Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.